This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. The podcast world has changed, and it changed 5 years ago by the popularity of Serial, a true crime saga produced by This American Life's Sarah Koenig. A number of true crime podcasts have gained popularity since then, including Crime Junkie, which is produced out of Indianapolis. But the show has faced accusations of plagiarism, and some critics say it sacrifices integrity for entertainment. Since the hosts don't claim to be journalists, should they get a pass? Joining me now is Adam Wren, a contributing editor for Indianapolis Monthly Magazine, who published his piece last month called The Problem with Crime Junkie. Adam, thanks for coming in.
Good to be with you, Matt.
And of course, you can chime in on Facebook and Twitter at All In Indiana, and we'll get your questions and comments to our live panel today. So before we get into this, what is the Crime Junkie podcast about?
So the Crime Junkie podcast is entering its second year this month, and it's essentially two women, one based here in Indianapolis and one who kind of dials in remotely from South Bend. And essentially, they talk about a crime du jour. So whether it's a crime that took place recently or one that took place as far back as the 1970s, and they re-examine the case. There's no original reporting for the most part. Essentially, they are reading almost like a Wikipedia entry about the suspects, how the police unraveled or didn't solve a crime, and they, sort of use that as some entertainment, and it's now become the number one or number two often true crime podcast in the nation. Generates about seven figures, and there's talk that it could lead to a possible television or film deal.
Seven figures is a lot of money to make on a podcast. Who are these hosts, and what did they do before this?
The lead host is Ashley Flowers, and she worked at Notre Dame University as a genetic researcher before she launched this podcast. She's also on the Central Indiana Crime Stoppers Board of Directors, and she actually started this podcast here in Indianapolis as a radio show that, would look at a murder of the week. It was called Murder Monday. It was a brief, 15-minute segment. And the idea was to raise the profile of Crime Stoppers of Central Indiana and, build a, sort of a bridge to a younger millennial generation to get them involved. And so she and her childhood friend, who worked as a private detective briefly before joining this podcast, launched a couple of years ago and, slowly bootstrapped it. They have a Patreon page, which is a crowdfunding platform where listeners can subscribe for monthly bonus episodes and other sort of, merch and for a monthly fee. And so that sort of sustains them, keeps them in business. They have a live show now. VIP tickets sell at about $120 for a meet and greet. And, the two of them have really sort of blown this up. They've got an office in Broad Ripple. They are, scaling up to six or seven employees. And so this has really become quite an enterprise.
Now, how popular is it? How many millions of downloads per week, per month? What are our numbers?
Recently, this could be as high as about 20 million downloads a month. So this is, listened to by a lot of people. It particularly the audience skews female, which is sort of a phenomenon that's not unfamiliar to people who subscribe to true crime. They have a younger audience, and this has become sort of a cultural icon over the last 2 years.
In your reporting, have you been able to talk to the people behind the show? Have they reached out to you for any reason?
I have. Early on in the reporting process, which began sort of late summer, they were involved with the story. They were on board. I spent some time on the phone with Ashley Flowers, the founder, working through her LA-based publicist. And as the story unfolded, they invited me to attend a live show on the campus of Butler University to sort of watch what they do and attend, kind of be a fly on the wall at the meet and greet as they sort of greeted and took selfies with their adoring fans. And, as the reporting progressed, they sort of broke off any cooperation once they sort of realized that I was, not necessarily writing a puff piece. that I was talking to victims' families, that I was talking to other journalists that they had plagiarized, and they, you know, sort of grew a bit contentious. And slightly shortly before the piece ran, you know, I kind of sent them a summary of our findings and, you know, what the piece was going to be disclosing, and never heard back. So they essentially broke off all contact.
What are these live shows like? How many people were there, and what are, is it just the podcast in front of a live audience, essentially?
Yeah, so they are on roughly a 15-city national tour, packing out venues from coast to coast. Here in Indianapolis, they had a crowd of about 2,000 people. And essentially, they retell a crime story that happened, similar to their podcast. And when I went to the show earlier this fall, essentially, the crime that they looked at was the disappearance of and murder of a six-year-old girl from Tucson, and she was raped and you know, turned up you know, essentially dead. For the first 20 minutes of the live show, they essentially lead the audience to believe by playing a 911 call that the father might be culpable, that the father of this murdered girl might be involved in her disappearance. And it turns out that's not the case at all. In fact, it was a sexual predator who the family didn't know, who was culpable, and who was found to be you know, connected to this crime. But they essentially used that entertainment you know, show to lead people to believe that, you know, it could be any number of suspects, despite having already known who's guilty and who is responsible for this sort of terrible, tragic moment. And they have found a way to monetize those tragic moments in families' lives in a way that, you know, troubles many sort of ethicists, but also other true crime writers.
The appeal and the entertainment factor of moments like that seem pretty simple. The hosts and the audience are trying to solve a mystery together. It's exciting to find new clues in a mystery. We'll get into some of the complicated reasons people seem fascinated by true crime in a bit. But is that how you see it, at least with that specific example, that the tone is just a little too lighthearted?
You know, there is the issue of tone. There's also the issue of, you know, what is the redeeming value here? A lot of great true crime is produced every day, every year, and oftentimes, you know, it goes beyond just sort of a titillation. It exposes wrongdoing. It exposes problems in the criminal justice system. It tells us about the human experience. You know, this show doesn't seem to touch any of those things. They would say, if they were here in the studio, that you know, their show promotes public safety, and to that extent, they are doing, they think, a public service. But my sense is, and the sense of people I talk to for this story, is that there's a dark side to what they do too, and they are essentially monetizing the worst moment in someone's life and using it as sort of a celebrity play. One of the results of podcasting has been that Hollywood studios look to podcasts like this one as a source of intellectual property. They may option the story behind a podcast, use it for a television show or a movie. And, you know, that's sort of the speculation here by some experts in the podcast industry of what's unfolding. And Flowers herself, in interviews with Deadline and Variety, has alluded to as much, that her latest podcast we can talk about, called Red Ball, looking at the 1978 Burger Chef murders, is essentially a play at getting some kind of a Hollywood deal.
What did you hear when you talked to people at the Butler event?
when I talked to people at the Butler event, I was struck by how much of a connection emotionally they felt with Flowers. Her voice is something that really connected with them, and they don't think that the show is doing anything wrong. They think that it's an entertainment podcast. They think that that it's something that makes their days. Their workaday lives worth living. They look forward to it when it comes out on Monday. It's something that deepens their experience. When I asked them about plagiarism charges, which have been first reported by BuzzFeed and New York Times and others earlier this fall, they sort of sloughed it off. They said that it didn't prevent them from listening to the podcast. That one person in particular said that everybody's doing plagiarism nowadays, so it's not really a problem for them.
But that simply isn't true, though, is it? That everyone is quote-unquote doing plagiarism these days.
I mean, there are occasional, significant events of plagiarism that seem to happen from time to time. For example, Jason Blair at the New York Times in the earlier part of this last decade had a significant lapse of plagiarism where he was using other reporters' work and passing it off as his own. But, plagiarism is not a widespread thing that's happening in the journalistic world. You'd have to be short-sighted to plagiarize another reporter's work when all of this is easily Googleable. And I think that that certainly it plagiarism is not something that's happening on a widespread basis.
And as you say in your piece, it is a career ender for journalists.
Absolutely.
But where this is concerned, where it's kind of an entertainment podcast, it gets blurry.
Yeah, one of the key defenses that Flowers and her show trots out whenever there's a question about plagiarism or about the journalistic ethics at play is that she will say she's not a journalist, but she is a true storyteller. She's a nonfiction storyteller, and there are obligations that come with that. One of the classic tensions of journalism is that it's not a licensed profession. You don't go to journalism school and get a certificate, a professional certificate that says you are now a professional journalist. Anybody can do journalism, and when you do it, regardless of whether or not you're aware of all of the responsibilities that come with it, there are key fundamental things that you should do that really determine the quality of the journalism that you create, and they are not doing those key fundamental things.
We're talking about the Crime Junkie podcast, and we'll talk more with writer Adam Wrenn and the true crime genre next after a break. As always, we'll take your questions and comments on social media. Do you listen to Crime Junkie or any other true crime podcasts? Why do you listen to them? Let us know on Facebook and Twitter at All In Indiana. I'm Matt Pelser. We're back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. Before we get back to our conversation on true crime podcasts, I want to tell you about a show we aired last week. For our Thanksgiving special, we talked about turkey, pie, small talk, and we heard a few holiday memories from some of the people behind the show. You can find that episode wherever you get podcasts. Today, we're talking about Crime Junkie, a true crime podcast produced in Indianapolis that's emerged as one of the most popular in the country. As always, we'd love your questions and comments on the topic. Should an entertainment podcast, however popular it may be, still be done ethically? Find us on Facebook and Twitter at All In Indiana. In the studio, we're joined again by Adam Wrenn. Adam is a contributing editor for Indianapolis Monthly, where he recently wrote about Crime Junkie. And we're welcoming now two guests, both from Side Effects Public Media here at WFYI, Lauren Bavis and Jake Harper. They produce the podcast Sick, about a fertility doctor who betrayed the trust of his patients. Lauren and Jake, thanks for coming down the hall.
Yeah, you bet.
Hey, Matt.
And a quick note before we get going, we did reach out to the producers and hosts of Crime Junkie to invite them onto the show today, but we did not hear back. Adam, let's broaden this a little bit. Before we get back to Crime Junkie, the true crime genre has existed for a long time in different forms, but it definitely got big in the podcast world in recent years. How did that happen?
You know, I think that we've seen this if you broaden out to the last few decades, really, you know, the last few hundred years. There are moments in history where true crime is particularly relevant, where it's resonant and it really kind of connects with people. And, you know, for us, we saw the most recent wave happen in 2014. And this was, I think, a moment when Americans, people really across the globe, were sort of, you know, turning inward. We had just gotten through a recession and, you know, we were sort of leaving the Obama years. And, you know, I think a lot of people felt sort of a malaise that really pressed them into true crime. You know, audio is a very, as you know, intimate format, and you connect with the person that you hear on the other end of the radio waves in a way that you don't digitally or even sometimes visually. You know, we often, you know, we actually learn to hear before we speak. And so I think that there's something primal about that. And so mixing, you know, true crime and audio, I think, has a really powerful way of gripping people's attention. And so we saw that when Serial released. And, you know, I think there's something in the air at the moment and the current zeitgeist about true crime that allows people to sort of leave the horror of the current moment that they're experiencing in their lives and sort of dial into to others' pain and to others' human experience. And, you know, I think there's something really important that happens in the human experience where there's empathy, there's connection, and sort of, you know, a brush with our own mortality that we get from true crime.
How would you describe the full spectrum of the true crime genre, regardless of the format that it's presented in? It seems like there are certain factors that differentiate them. There's a pretty wide gap between a plain fact-based retelling of a case and something like Truman Capote's In Cold Blood, for example.
Yeah, and even Truman Capote's In Cold Blood has been questioned in recent years as to some of the quality of reporting that's happened there. But yes, there are gradations of quality in true crime. You know, I've written true crime stories myself, and there are a lot of amazing crime reporters with outlets like the Marshall Project, a sister magazine of Indianapolis Monthly, Texas Monthly does some phenomenal true crime work on a daily basis. You know, the Sick Podcast is you know, great true crime telling. And I think that, you know, there's also a certain subset of true crime stories on podcasts like Crime Junkie and My Favorite Murder, where there's not any sort of original reporting done. There's very little effort to reach out to the victims or the families of victims and sort of get their buy-in to tell a story. Because whenever you go back and tell the story of a crime that happened, you risk, you know, re-traumatizing the victims or the family of the victims by sharing that story again. And so I think that there's some ethical legwork that needs to be done before you embark on a true crime endeavor that podcasts like Crime Junkie are not endeavoring to undertake.
Jake Harper, you and Lauren Bavis have spent a lot of time making this first season of Sick, which we just referenced. Can you explain what it's about and how the podcast is structured?
Yeah, sure. So Sick is a serialized health journalism show where we sort of set out to borrow elements of true crime, but instead of talking about the criminal justice system, we are focusing on the healthcare industry where plenty of injustice happens every day. And so in our first season, we decided to dive into the fertility industry and to do that over multiple episodes. And what we did was we focused on a story that happened right here in Indianapolis, as you mentioned, on this fertility doctor named Donald Klein, who deceived dozens of his patients and decided to use his own sperm to impregnate them instead of the sperm of their husbands or of an anonymous sperm donor.
What's your process been like researching and reporting on the story for the podcast? Has it been different than the process of reporting the more traditional kind of feature stories that we air on our station?
Yeah, I mean, it was different partly because we sort of came late to the story. I mean, I knew about the Donald Klein story for a few years, and it never really felt like something that sort of fit into my job description as a reporter who focuses on public health. And so we all sort of knew what that story was, but had deeper questions that we wanted to probe into, such as what is this really like for the victims, and you know, why did Klein do this? I mean, there were so many questions that just weren't answered by the sort of day-to-day reporting on the case as it unfolded, that we wanted to get deeper and uncover something new and try to get more perspectives and really get a sense of what it's like for the people who are affected by this. So we started really reporting on this about 10 months ago, I guess. And so, you know, part of our time was taken up by just learning how to do a podcast because we haven't done that before. But we, you know, we spent a lot of time reaching out to the sort of biological children of Donald Klein, a group of people sort of known as the siblings or the half siblings, and to his former patients, their mothers, and in some cases their fathers, and we also spent a lot of time reaching out to Klein, trying to get him to talk to us.
But it wasn't that you were learning how to do a podcast. You was learning how to do the kind of podcast that you want to do, because there are these podcasts like Crime Junkie where it is just two people kind of sitting and talking and in some cases just going through a Wikipedia page. In your case, you're doing investigative journalism.
Sure, and we're presenting it in a sort of long-form audio format that is new to us in a way. I mean, we do four-minute radio features as sort of what our bread and butter used to be. And now we're producing episodes that are 30 minutes long, which really allows you a lot more freedom. In that freedom, you kind of have to like learn, you know, how to write better, and for lack of a better term.
Well, Lauren, how do you see Sick fitting into the bigger true crime genre? Did you and Jake talk about what kind of true crime show this would be?
Yeah, we definitely did. And I listened to a bunch of true crime shows as I was trying to figure out where we thought Sick could fit into the genre. And like you said, we didn't want it to be a show where it was, you know, just Jake and I talking and riffing back and forth about a case. We knew that we wanted it to be rooted in investigative journalism. Jake and I are journalists first and foremost. And so with that, we came to the story with our reporting background and researching and interviewing and all of that. And we wanted the show to fit into the true crime space in a different way as well. We wanted it to be educational. I think that we come to any kind of reporting wanting it to have a way that people who come after listening to it or reading it leave better informed. In this case, we wanted them to be better health consumers when it comes to getting fertility treatment if they chose to do that. And yeah, we decided to do that through a true crime lens. So we borrowed some of these elements of true crime. You know, it's a really interesting way of doing storytelling. It's suspenseful and it has heroes and villains, and so we borrowed from that, but we still see ourselves as an investigative journalism product.
Adam, one of Crime Junkie's mottos is be weird, be rude, stay alive. What does that mean, and how does it relate to the show?
Essentially, it's a talking point that the hosts often use to convey to their listeners the importance of personal safety. You know, how they should behave in a public setting. You know, they should be weird and not inviting to strangers. And they should be rude and not sort of you know, open. You know, that will help them stay alive. And it's sort of based on their experience of telling a number of stories that often feature you know, female victims, and they're sort of offering you know, best practices. It's almost sort of like an after-school special in that way. And you know, their contention is that, you know, that focus on public safety. And I should also mention, you know, they do donate a portion of their income to you know, crime-stopping organizations and nonprofits. But they believe that that sort of absolves them of the exploitative nature of what they do.
On Crime Junkie's website, the bio for co-host Britt ends with this line, quote, "Britt worked for a PI for a while, which in my eyes basically qualifies her to be a crime research expert. That being said, if our facts are ever wrong," and this is in all caps, "we are not experts, just junkies," end quote. And I should note, because I think it's relevant here that the phrase "we are not experts" is emphasized in all caps. What do you make of this when you read it? What does it say about how they see themselves and their role in the show?
Well, for people who earn seven figures and are listened to by tens of millions of people each month, it's not really up to them to decide whether or not they are experts. Other people come to them, their audience members come to them, you know, assuming a certain amount of expertise. And there's a tension in that disclaimer that you read, because, you know, if she had worked for a private eye, she's essentially saying that she's an expert at sort of reinvestigating old crimes. But they are clear that they don't do that. In their latest project that has come out, Red Ball, which looks at the 1978 Burger Chef murders, you know, they essentially are very clear that they're not going to be trying to turn up new leads in the case or talking to potential witnesses. And so it's not altogether clear to me what the purpose is of that disclaimer, other than to sort of, you know, cover themselves from a legal perspective. But, you know, they are creating what has now become a cultural good, and there are responsibilities that go along with that. You know, we've talked about the Dr. Klein story, Indianapolis Monthly. You know, actually, I worked on a profile, a story of Klein and his victims. You know, we reached out, as did the Sick Podcast, to people who have been hurt by this person, you know, seeking their participation and their permission to tell their story. And not that that permission is essential to get before you tell the story, but there ought to be an effort by a true crime teller, a nonfiction true crime teller, to sort of involve people who have been hurt or victimized by someone in the story. And that's not happening in this case with Crime Junkie.
Jake, do you think some true crime content, because of how it's produced and presented, crosses a line at a certain point and should no longer be considered journalism? Are there issues when the line between journalism and entertainment gets a little blurry?
I mean, I think the answer is yes. I mean, I should say that I'm not a huge consumer of true crime stuff, ironically enough. But I think there's a big difference. There's sort of a big gap between shows like Serial or In the Dark and a show like Crime Junkies or My Favorite Murder. I mean, one to me is journalism. Like you're, like Adam said, you're reaching out to people who are affected by the story. You know, in our case, we were, you know, requesting documents, we're getting recordings and things that that were going to play a major role in how we sort of fact check and tell the story. Whereas other people are sort of, you know, Crime Junkies included, are sort of basing their show off of other people's journalism and sources that aren't necessarily specifically even referenced in the show. And I think that's sort of the major difference that I see, is one is sort of more commentary and the other is actual journalism.
Lauren, it seems like a central point to all this is about journalistic ethics. A lot of people who are fans of Crime Junkie and shows like it might say that the show is just fun and that it assumes a different role than a piece of investigative journalism like Sick, and therefore it doesn't have to abide by all the strict rules of that format. What do you make of that?
It's interesting because, I mean, I think the reason that true crime shows are so popular is because they're entertaining. I mean, there's a reason whenever I'm in a hotel room, I see if there's a marathon of Law & Order SVU on. It's something that engages people and sucks them in. And like Adam said, a lot of the fans of true crime are people who are more likely to be the victims of it. It's hard because I think that the two, both investigative journalism and sort of the kind of riffing Crime Junkie, My Favorite Murder style shows, can learn from each other. I mean, we borrowed some of those aspects of storytelling. You know, Sick, these are half-hour episodes, but they didn't start in the first 5 minutes. We said, here's everything that you need to know, and here's everything we're going to, you know, explore with you. We took our listeners on a journey. But the people that you hear from in, you know, in the past episodes of Sick, some of them have had years, like Jake said, to kind of deal with the trauma of their experiences. In the episode that we have out coming out tomorrow, you'll hear people who, this is only this revelation about what Klein did to their parents and his role in their lives. They've only known that for a couple of months. And to them, I mean, this experience is anything but fun. So there's a balance to be had, for sure.
How are you and Jake handling citations when you use information from someone else's reporting on your podcast?
Yeah, so, I mean, we knew coming into the Sick story, covering the Klein story, that there had been reporting done on this for years. And we read a lot of that to see what had been covered. And I think we knew going into it that we weren't going to crib from other sources. That's just not, I mean, how news reporting typically works. We knew if we were going to try to talk to sources that other news outlets had talked to, we wanted to do our own primary interview. So the people you'll hear from in Sick have been interviewed before, a lot of the siblings or the experts or people who surrounded this case legally. You've heard from them before, but we were asking our own questions. We were actually, you know, in the room interviewing them. But I think maybe the primary example of reporting we borrowed would be from Angela Ganote, the reporter at Fox 59 who helped break this story back in 2015. She didn't actually get to use Klein's name, but she talked about some of the issues that donor-conceived people go through in finding out about, you know, who they are. And we thought the best way to do that would be to let Angela tell her own story, to kind of make her into a character in our piece and talk about what it was like from, you know, first getting this news tip that something was going on that needed to be investigated to trying to reach out to Klein in the meetings that she the meetings she eventually had with him. So that's what we thought would be the best way to do that, was to actually bring in a journalist to show just how much work goes into any kind of investigation.
Adam, we have less than a minute to go, but something happened earlier this year that really crystallized this issue, and we'll carry this over into the next segment. But a former journalist from Arkansas listened to an episode of Crime Junkie, and what happened next?
Essentially, she realized that what she was hearing was word for word verbatim the product of her reporting that took place years ago into the murder of a young child, reporting that was hard earned, reporting that you know, she spent late nights with the victims to produce, and realized essentially that the Crime Junkie hosts had cribbed not only from the facts but the actual sentences that she crafted.
We'll be back to talk more about Crime Junkie and journalistic integrity next on All In. I'm Matt Pelser. We're back in 90 seconds. This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. We're back with Adam Wren, contributing editor for Indianapolis Monthly, and Lauren Bavis and Jake Harper from SideFX Public Media, producers and hosts of Sick, which you can find wherever you get podcasts. We're talking about journalistic integrity, specifically when we're referring to the Indianapolis-produced podcast Crime Junkie, and we welcome your comments in the last 8 minutes or so that we have. Cold Case Chronicles on Twitter says, I agree with you 100% about sources. Stealing other people's hard work is wrong no matter what platform you're on. I also strongly agree with being cautious to victims' families. At the end of the day, it's about respect above ratings, which, Adam, was kind of the tone that I got from your piece in Indianapolis Monthly.
That's right. Yeah. You know, I think that there is a problem when you sort of come in and sort of exploit the worst tragedies that people have experienced in their lives for content without any sort of human interaction happening or any sort of effort to get their perspectives on how that impacted them.
Back to the Arkansas journalist who heard the episode of Crime Junkie that kind of got this all going. How did the hosts respond to that initially?
You know, they responded in a sort of surreptitious manner. They, without any sort of fanfare, they took down a certain portion of past podcasts that may have used other people's work. They put out a statement on Facebook, sort of acknowledging that they sort of try to cite sources whenever possible, and they really haven't addressed it beyond that. When I specifically asked them about this case with an Arkansas journalist who was plagiarized, you know, their PR person sort of broke into the interview and said that Flowers would not be addressing the plagiarism accusations. So it's difficult to know where they're at in the process of fulfilling the promise they made in their statement, which is that they would be, you know, citing sources going forward and that they would be a leader in the true crime podcast space about developing, you know, more sort of new ethical ways to cite sources, which can be difficult to do in an audio format.
Adam, a new project from Crime Junkie is focused on a famous old unsolved case in Indianapolis. What's it about?
Yeah, so the podcast is called Red Ball. It debuted on November 25th and immediately shot to the top of iTunes charts, and it essentially looks at the efforts of a new person on the case, a new detective, First Sergeant Bill Dalton with the Indiana State Police, and his efforts to sort of digitize the old case files and turn up new leads in the case. And as part of that, Flowers became one of the only, perhaps the only member of the public to see the full case file of the Burger Chef murder. And as part of that, the Indiana State Police said, you know, to Dalton that this was beyond the scope of their agreement to partner with Crime Junkie, and actually sort of wrote this particular sergeant up for his participation with this podcast. And, you know, none of that is disclosed in the podcast itself, Red Ball.
This it comes from Clay on Twitter for Adam. If Ashley and Britt had simply interviewed the journalists who wrote the stories and incorporated the interviews on their podcast, would Crime Junkie still be plagiarizing the journalists' work?
Of course not. You know, you can look at any you know, nonfiction documentary that, you know, brings in reporters who have covered a true crime case, or, you know, a presidential administration, whatever it may be, and they sort of lend their insight in the documentary itself. That same thing could have happened with Kathy Fry, the Arkansas reporter in question.
And why was it an issue, going back to the Burger Chef conversation, why is it an issue that Flowers got this access to these files?
That's a great question. In Indiana, we have public records request laws that would require Indiana State's police, if they show one member of the public the case file, to show that to other journalists. And journalists have sought, journalists and other true crime podcasters have sought this particular case file for years. And, you know, they would be required to disclose that case file to other people as well, in addition to Flowers, because they showed it to her. They would sort of lose any claim to protecting those case notes, which are actually protected in Indiana. Law enforcement officers, you know, aren't required to disclose, you know, interviews that they've had with suspects, for example. But, you know, by sharing that information with Flowers, they would have been required to share it with other reporters. And so this is a conflict that actually went to the state's public records ombudsman, and he sort of looked at the case and had to make an adjudication. I you know, I think that's problematic. And the fact that they shared it not with a journalist, but with someone who has sort of a dubious ethical track record, and that's something that Indiana State Police knew within the last months before this podcast launched. You know, I think that's problematic and a poor use of taxpayer dollars, and really an affront to the victims and their families in the Burger Chef case. Because rather than spend time, you know, looking at this case and trying to turn up new leads on the 41st anniversary, you know, the sergeant in question was becoming sort of a podcast star himself, and actually told me in an interview that he spent about 40 hours of, you know, taxpayer-funded time participating in this podcast.
Jake, how should working with police and using information that you've gotten from them go on a podcast, or maybe any kind of reporting?
I mean, we haven't had to do this yet for our podcast because we're like I said, we're focused on the healthcare industry. I think, you know, working with any major institution, you want to come with a sense of skepticism. And, you know, generally speaking, our job as journalists is to sort of speak truth to power. And I think, you know, what has happened with Red Ball, seemingly, you know, it's partnering with a police organization, is kind of antithetical to what journalists do, which is sort of remain independent. You know, there are sort of debates about sort of journalism objectivity, but the goal is not to sort of partner with a major institution like a police force and sort of tell their side of a story.
Adam, in the last minute that we have, less than a minute, do you think that there's room for a show like this to some degree to turn true crime into light entertainment? Would it work if it were done differently? Or do you think that the concept itself is kind of a problem?
I think the concept itself is kind of a problem. I think there is admirable true crime reporting that happens every day in America. But, you know, the idea of using someone else's experience for entertainment grates me as a journalist.
I want to thank all of our guests today. Adam Wren, contributing editor for Indianapolis Monthly. Thank you so much.
Good to be with you.
Lauren Bavis and Jake Harper from Side Effects Public Media, producers and hosts of Sick, which you can find wherever you get podcasts. Thank you both for taking the time.
Yeah, thanks.
Always happy to be here.
We're going to close out today's show with a conversation that I had with the author of a new true crime book that came out this past summer. I'm Matt Pelser. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. November 17th, 1978. If you're a true crime buff, that date might ring in your memory as the night of the Burger Chef kidnappings and subsequent murders. Four young employees of the former Burger Chef at 5725 Crawfordsville Road were victims of a heinous crime that night. To this day, remains unsolved. Well, one Indiana author has spent quite a bit of time exploring that unfortunate piece of history. The book is The Burger Chef Murders in Indiana. And she joins us now. Julie Young, thanks for stopping by.
No problem. Thanks for having me.
40 years have gone by. We still don't have an answer.
Nope.
And you explained that you knew that you weren't going to be the one to solve the crime. You also say that you knew that writing this book would be tough, and it turns out that it certainly was. Why then did you decide to write it?
Because I don't want the case forgotten. Because obviously, anything that they cannot solve in 40 years, I'm not going to solve in two. And it would be kind of cheap for me to try, you know, I mean, given how much time and effort has been put toward this case. But I thought it was very important because so much has been written about it, and oftentimes only in a retrospective kind of way, you know, a quick summation of the case, that I thought it was kind of important to go back and sort of talk about the events leading up to it, you know, the initial reaction, you know, and then the subsequent reactions over the years as different developments, some promising, some not so much.
So your goal was essentially to be a reminder.
Yes.
That this happened. Four young people, Daniel Davis, 16, Jane Freet, 20, Ruth Ellen Shelton, 17, Mark Fleming, 16. Those are the victims. You dedicate the book to them. Mm-hmm. How much was focusing on them part of the writing process? Did you try to just stick with the facts, or was there an emotional component to your motivation?
Obviously, as a writer, you want to stick to the facts. But anybody who grew up in that era knew somebody who worked at Burger Chef. It could have been one of them. You know, it could have easily been, you know, I had friends who had brothers and sisters that were teenagers, you know, who worked in fast food. So there was always that idea in the back of your head after you learn about the case and, you know, kind of follow it for a while, gee, this could have been anybody. So, and as a parent, you know, I cannot imagine what it would be like to pass not knowing who or why my child, who killed my child and why they were killed. So that was kind of important to me, too. I mean, I really tried to take a very sensitive approach to it. I did not try to go into any kind of conspiracy theories or anything like that. I really kept it very much to what was publicly known about the case.
You go through the timeline of events in detail in the book, obviously. But what did you uncover that was surprising to you that people who just followed maybe the news surrounding this case might not know?
You know, I honestly think it's been fairly well covered. You know, as far as what happened, really one thing that a lot of people, when they hear about or when they've read the book, is the thing that really hits them is the fact that it came on the heels of two other main events. It came after the Julia Skyfers killing in July in her garage, and then on top of it, the week-long Speedway bombings. So you had two very strange events that at the time when the Burger Chef kidnappings happened, they didn't know who was responsible for the other two. So there was this idea of what is going on in Speedway. And a lot of people who maybe have not followed it or only learned about it after the fact or didn't live here at that time and don't remember the other two events are really kind of surprised to find out how this all sort of happens within months of each other. And so while the timeline of the actual murder and or kidnapping and subsequent murders, I think the timeline of that is more or less well-documented, I think it's the broader context that sometimes people don't understand or don't realize or don't understand. And also the fact that the kids were found on the same day that Jim Jones and company down in Guyana drank the Kool-Aid.
also an Indianapolis tie. Oh, my goodness.
It was a big day for Indiana, front page of news.
Oh, wow. No, I'm not familiar with the other two Speedway crimes. Did they eventually become solved?
Yeah, but there was a gentleman who was sort of arrested in connection with them. Yeah.
With both of them? Was there any connection found or suspected with this one?
At one time, there was a very, very loose thought that there might be a connection, but there wasn't.
Years go by after the murders, a few leads here and there, but nothing goes anywhere. And then in 1986, we get a confession. Tell us about that.
Yeah, confession in quotes. A man by the name of Donald Ray Forrester ultimately ended up confessing to the crime. And there was a lot of speculation as to what his motivation would be for confessing to the crime. Did he have anything to do with it? Was he actually the one who committed the crime, or was he simply there? Was he part of it but not the culprit? And it was quite a story that spanned 2 years to get this confession out of him. And then, of course, the very next day he recants. And honestly, they were never able to bring it to like a grand jury because you only get one bite at that apple. You know, and considering the fact that this crime had affected so many people in the city and the families really wanted answers, nobody was going to feel good about possibly trying a guy on speculation. And so he was never brought before a grand jury. Keep in mind, though, he was already a guest of the state, you know, so it wasn't like he was going anywhere anytime soon. He never was actually convicted for it.
Well, there have been a few times over the years that people have come forward claiming to have information. What's kept that from furthering the case? Is there any talk of going back to any of that?
Well, I know that as of obviously last November, you know, they released a picture of the knife that killed Jane Freed or the knife blade, and, you know, suggested that perhaps somebody might know something about an individual who may have carried a similar knife or something like that. That might lead to something. Obviously, now DNA evidence or forensic testing has become so much better than, you know, that it wasn't even existent back then. So it's hard telling. I mean, you never know. The state police have certainly said they still get calls on the case every year. A lot of times the leads they've already checked out or it doesn't go anywhere. So it's hard telling. It's really hard telling.
There's got to be hope in your mind that someday we have answers.
You know, there is. And more importantly, and something that was very important to me because I knew I would not solve this case when I wrote the book, one thing that I think is important is when talking about hope and solving cases, there are other unsolved cases out there that are a little fresher than this one. And, you know, whether it's the Delphi girls, whether it's Lauren Speer, whether it's the case of Denise Slum from Connersville, you know, in the mid-80s, you know, there are cases similar to this that happen all the time. The seemingly random thing that, you know, somebody had to have known something. You know, why isn't that person coming forward? Or how did this happen? You know, was it just that random, you know, that something just awful and terrible happened to an individual or individuals? And so what's really important is, no, the Burger Chef case should never be forgotten, but neither should these other ones, you know, that may not be quite as high profile as this particular one.
Something else that was very interesting that I had forgotten about, actually, in 2015, a former coworker of mine, Jake Query from sports talk station WNDE, found out that Mark Fleming's grave, one of the victims, his grave at Crown Hill Cemetery was actually unmarked.
Yes.
And he's a big local history buff, Jake is, and so what he does not surprise me at all. But I had forgotten about this. What did Jake do?
He got together people who wanted to donate from Speedway High School who were in Mark's class or adjacent, and they brought him a headstone. And I was able to go visit the grave, and it's very nice. It puts the year that he would have graduated from Speedway on there, and I think that's really nice for them to do.
Jake has thousands of Twitter followers, and so they all kind of came through really fast, too.
Yes, yes. It didn't take any time at all. So, and it's a very nice little stone, and, you know, it's things like that. You know, we don't want these kids forgotten. You know, they were here. They were real people. They matter, you know. And so, their lives had tons of promise that was all taken away.
Anything else you'd care to share about the book whatsoever?
I just hope that everybody realizes that it was never my intention to solve it. It is not my intention to exploit any of the victims. It was my intention to treat everybody with sensitivity and just to simply put the facts in place in such a way that the story will always be preserved.
And to honor the victims. The book is The Burger Chef Murders in Indiana. It's out now. I assume we can find it on local interest shelves across the state?
Absolutely.
Julie Young, thanks for your work, and thanks for coming on All In.
Thank you.
Our producers are Drew Dodlin and Maggie Galon. Scott Cameron is our managing editor. Our show is engineered by Adam Gross. You can find our podcast wherever you get podcasts, and please subscribe so you always know what we're up to. Join us tomorrow when we'll talk about the high infant and maternal mortality rates in Indiana and some of the efforts to improve them. I'm Matt Pelser. Thanks for listening. This is All In.